You're listening to the Incarcerated Christian Podcast, where we shine light on the dark side of Christianity and how it affects people and communities. I'm Robin Mitchell Stroud, and I'm here with my co-host, Deborah Levy Martinelli. We'll be covering a variety of topics, from individual survivor stories, including our own, to the influence of religion on our national politics. To learn more about the podcast, visit our website, theincarceratedchristian.com, or connect with us on TikTok and Instagram at The Incarcerated Christian, and on Twitter at @TICC_podcast_. Now, on to the show. Hey, everybody. Our guest today is Rabbi Ted Falcon. He's a spiritual therapist in private practice and a popular speaker, author, and teacher of a universal spirituality honoring the interconnectedness of all life. Rabbi Falcon was ordained at the Hebrew Union College Jewish Institute of Religion in Cincinnati and earned a doctorate in clinical psychology with a research focus on the nature of meditative and mystical states of consciousness. He founded universally focused synagogue communities in both Los Angeles and Seattle, and pioneered the revival of authentic Jewish spiritual traditions. With Imam Jamal Rahman and Pastor Don McKenzie, Rabbi Falcon is one of the Interfaith Amigos, who started working together after 9/11. Since then, they have brought their unique blend of spiritual wisdom and humor to audiences across the United States, as well as Canada, Israel, Palestine, and Japan. Their work is dedicated to supporting more effective interfaith dialogue that can bring greater collaboration on the major social and economic issues of our time. The Three Amigos have written three books: Getting to the Heart of Interfaith, The Eye-Opening, Hope-Filled Friendship of a Pastor, a Rabbi, and an Imam, Finding Peace Through Spiritual Practice, and Religion Gone Astray, What We Found at the Heart of Interfaith, which has been called an exuberant and courageous book that is an inspiration and example for all of us in these sadly polarized times, and a reminder that it is possible to reach across the divisions and find not only common cause, but hope and affection. Rabbi Falcon also is the co-author of Judaism for Dummies and author of A Journey of Awakening, Kabbalistic Meditations on the Tree of Life. And since early 2020, Rabbi Falcon has increasingly been a part of the Anoki Institute, working with Tova Zev, a spiritual teacher ordained in the Essene tradition, to developing programs supporting greater spiritual awakening. And listeners, you can find links to Rabbi Falcon's website, books, and more in the show notes. So welcome, Rabbi Falcon.
It's good to be here. I appreciate the opportunity to chat.
Thank you. We will call you Dr. Ted, as you requested, going forward this morning.
Actually, it was Rabbi Ted.
But oh, did I say Father Ted? Oh, my gosh. Father Ted?
You could call me Ted, or you could call me Hey You.
I'm going to try and remember Rabbi Ted, because I'm the Jewish part of the duo here. So
the important thing to know about Rabbi Ted is that it can also be read as Rabbit Ed.
Oh, I love it.
I noticed that on your email. So we could just go with Rabbit Ed.
Yeah. When I tried to get it as a domain name, rabbited.com is the best way for people to reach me. But at the beginning, I couldn't get it because the site was owned by a pet food company.
That's good.
Oh, that's great. Well, I want to start with Judaism for Dummies, because I thought that would be a good place for me to sort of reconnect with my history and my traditions. And you said in your introduction to that book that you offered some reasons for the interest in Judaism in recent years. And some of those were searching for meaningful connections to the past, hungering for deeper understanding and ritual, exploring the rich tapestry of Judaism, both Jews and non-Jews, for non-Jews, a greater openness to appreciating the depth of Judaism without seeing it as a threat to other faiths, and for Jews recovering from Holocaust horrors and rediscovering that the faith and practice still exists. And also, and maybe most importantly, increasing realization that Judaism has much to offer in the mystical, meditative, and spiritual realms. So my question to you, for a Jew for whom many of these resonate, as you look back from the time you wrote that introduction several years ago, which of these, if any, have you noticed to become most prominent?
It's interesting. You know, often when I hear or read words that I participated in writing, I have no recollection of writing them. You know, it's almost as if reading something that someone else has written. But there's no doubt, as I listen and respond to that question, that the last thing you mention is the first thing, and in many ways, the only thing I focus on. You know, I've been involved in interfaith activities for a very, very long time. It's no accident that I became part of the Interfaith Amigos, which is now almost 20 years that we've been working together. But even before that, I was focused on building bridges, you know, because religion has become increasingly now a divisive rather than a unitive reality. Religion has been co-opted by the institution, and institutions, by their very nature, have needs that eclipse the very purpose for which institutions themselves were formed. And I don't care whether they're educational institutions, governmental institutions, religious institutions, health institutions. It's a problem with the form of institution. So in a lot of ways, it's teasing out, okay, what was this formed for? Why was this important at the beginning? How did it go astray? And how do we reclaim the essential teaching, the essential message? As far as I can tell, every authentic spiritual tradition is an avenue to a shared universal. And any time any path thinks it owns the universal, we are all in trouble. And that trouble will manifest through some kind of violence, whether that violence is emotional, psychological, physical. It can't help it. So I become, frankly, less interested in interfaith, you know, and intrafaith, and more interested in what I would now call beyond faith.
Oh,
which
wow.
Which is to say, what is all of it for? What is Judaism for? And this is speaking directly to, you know, your question. Namely, if what Judaism is for is the perpetuation of an institutionalized Judaism, then frankly, I'm not interested. I'm not Christian, but I would say what Christianity is about, whatever denomination, is about strengthening that denomination, strengthening that belief system, making bigger buildings, having a better functioning operation, filling sanctuaries. I'm not interested. If we are asking of our own traditions and if we are inviting of another traditions, how does that help us wake up? How does that help us leave the silos of separateness and open to the essential oneness of all being? And if it doesn't, it needs to be thrown away. I'm sorry, it's not worthwhile. How have we misplaced and misinterpreted and misread even ancient teachings, sabotaging the very message which is the reason for their survival? Torah, I mean, talk about my tradition. Torah is really like the Vedas. You know, it's like the Western world's oldest surviving teachings that have just, well, that's not accidental that it survived. But the way it's being used is tragic. The essential message is there's only one. you know, from your background, no matter to what extent you grew up Jewish, you know a line called the Shema. The book of Devarim, which is Deuteronomy chapter 6, verse 4, that says, listen, listen. And it says, listen, Israel, but that's way before. Israel was not a country. Israel was this people. And there was a people because that was Jacob's name. This is a tribe. Listen. And Yisrael, it could be translated by the woman I work with now, who is often so much more spiritually attuned than I, translates Yisrael as, listen, all of you who seek to open to the essential nature of being, which is to say, all of you who seek to open to God. This is not just for people who think they're Jewish, not, you know, I mean, here Jesus is seen as quoting it. I mean, for goodness sakes, listen, that isness, that being, that one is our God. That's what it says. And everything is one. Hello, it's one, it's one. What follows from that is the next line, and then what follows from that is love. Knowing, opening to oneness, allows a radical love. And I'm not talking about romantic love. I'm talking about an embracing, natural connectivity of love.
So, Rabbi Ted,
the problem with asking me a question is you're going to get a sermon.
No, this is great. Yeah. No, seriously, because you are talking about it, what you have just set up was my very first question for you, Mike, first question for you. And it's also one of the favorite things that I read in one of your books. But, you know, our podcast is the Incarcerated Christian Podcast, metaphorically incarcerated, where that sort of inner exploration is just not, it's just not taught, not promoted, not, you know, it's like, and one of the things that you wrote in, I think it was the, which book was it? I have it with me somewhere. Anyway, it's the glass analogy. You said that spirituality, which is that inner kind of work, might be seen as the water of life, but without a glass, it is far more difficult to drink. At best, the institution serves as the container. At worst, the institution believes it alone has access to the water and is unaware when the container, in fact, is empty. And so I'm wondering if you're sort of raised being contained and not in a good way, how did you learn that? Because we also read that you were sort of experimenting with spirituality when you were pretty young, maybe in your teens, you were doing that kind of exploration. So how did you learn that that was okay to do given the container? Or how would one learn? Like, what? How do you even get to the parts where you can see this bigger picture if you sort of are raised in an environment like I was raised in?
That's a great question. I'm not sure I can answer it. You know, when I even think back about some of the things I did as a teenager, some of the things I was interested in, that I didn't know anybody else was interested in it. You know, I mean, I had no friends who were interested in it. I had, God bless my parents, but God knows what they thought, you know.
Did they give you the latitude to do that kind of exploring or the room?
I think they humored me. You know, I remember being fascinated with I didn't have the words then, but with consciousness, you know, like, and I got fascinated with hypnosis. I didn't know anything about meditation. I mean, that was not, you got to remember, I'm very old and I come from a context in which that was simply, I mean, we had something in a religious service called silent meditation that lasted for about a minute and had very little to do with anything that was actually meditation. I found ways to get downtown. I grew up in Cleveland, Ohio, which explains a lot of things. I found ways to get downtown, and I had found this little magic store up these creaky stairs, you know, just this weird place. I just think of myself, this kid who's just appears, and I'm stay there as long as I possibly can, watching and listening and seeing these books on hypnosis and saving up money so that I could buy some of those books. And, you know, what is happening here and how can I practice, you know, and
that was okay. Or you just,
I don't remember asking the question.
Uh-huh. Okay.
I don't remember even, I mean, I remember in those years, what was called junior high school, taking a couple of friends into the darkened auditorium in lunch hour and experimenting with trance.
Oh, now, wow. Yeah.
Now, what gave me the gall? I just, you know, when I think back, I just can't imagine. But there's something that was just compelling. You know, I think all of us, I think it is, see, the one of the problems with this is that what we're talking about and what I think I'm talking about is actually the essential nature of our being. It's not something we're not. It's something we've been trained out of. So it's like deconstructing the training.
Yes.
Allows us the opportunity to go, wait a minute, this is what was happening all the time. This is who I always was, which is why what we call awakening is such a paradoxical event, because the ego keeps thinks it's going somewhere. There's some kind of path that's leading us somewhere rather than letting go of this whole, there's nowhere to go. Where there is to go is here.
Like a returning to, not a going to.
Right. So,
yeah.
All I can tell you is that I had the good fortune of having clues presented to me along the way that sometimes I noticed and probably most often I did not. But I noticed enough to set a trajectory and to discover along the way how I did not fit in the institutionalized worlds that I kept trying to fit into.
So that leads me to a follow-up question, precisely what you said. Your trajectory was fairly traditional, right? You went to rabbinical school, and then you got a degree in psychology. But all of this time, you also had this spiritual awakening, if you will. How did those integrate or conflict?
Well, I need to say that seminary practically killed any spirituality. Meditation was frowned upon, laughed at. I mean, it was really phenomenal. What drew me to seminary was something I didn't find there.
Ah, yes.
I was, it's irrelevant to go into a lot of this stuff, but I think in my third year of college, of undergraduate school, I found Martin Buber. And Martin Buber talked about what now I would call a state of consciousness that involved a meeting, a radically different kind of meeting of I and I, rather than me and me, or rather than me and you. And there was something I knew about that. And there was something, I decided in my naivete that going to seminary, going to rabbinical school would deepen that. I would find more Martin Buber in seminary. What I did find was that people did not like him. They did not like him because he didn't identify with any particular school of Judaism. He didn't identify with any particular practice of Judaism. And he was also one of the very earliest in Israel to be in favor of a binational state. So he was not held in high regard at my seminary. I remember even interviewing for one of the jobs I had after ordination. And when I mentioned Buber as part of my theology, one of the interviewers laughed. You know, it was like so far away from how they viewed things.
Well, you have since found your people, as it were, and two of those people are the other interfaith amigos. Can you talk to us a little bit about how you all met and started working together after 9/11?
Yeah, I knew each of them in a slightly different context. I knew Jamal. There was a group, there was a little group that was trying to start a spiritual university in Seattle to offer a master's degree in spirituality, and it was to be called Tahoma University. Tahoma is the native indigenous name for Mount Rainier. And they invited me to be on the board of this group that was forming this, and Jamal was on the board. I was identified as a spiritually inclined rabbi. He was identified as a spiritually inclined imam. When 9/11 happened, when that tragedy unfolded, Jamal actually was the first person I called, because the initial response was such anti-Muslim, anti-Islamic rhetoric that really was, I mean, that in itself was criminal. I mean, you just, and I knew that people had to see a different face of Islam. So I invited Jamal to join me for Shabbat service that Friday. It was the first time actually we had ever worked together. I mean, we knew each other in these meetings, but we'd never met or really talked to each other. He got a chance to hear what I was teaching. I got a chance to hear what he was teaching, and we started walking together and working together. Don and I knew each other because we participated in something called an interfaith dialogue group in Seattle. Again, it was always an interest of mine. So I found a group of clergy who were meeting regularly. And about halfway through that first year, as we were preparing a program to mark the anniversary of 9/11, we invited Don. We talked to Don about it. Actually, we had an agenda of finding a larger sanctuary, and he had one, and he agreed. And as we prepared, you know, we got to the end, and it became very clear that we didn't know where this was going, but we knew it was important. So we started meeting a minimum of once a week. After a couple of years, we did a radio show once a week for a year called Interfaith Talk Radio. You know, it wasn't a smooth path. You know, we worked a lot together to try to get any kind of traction or any kind of attention. We got very lucky. We had a program in Nashville, and I don't remember the year, maybe 2008 or something. And the religion reporter from the New York Times came down, and it was lucky.
Took off from there.
Yeah. It's like then we got very busy, you know, and it peaked. So right now, and I also think that the whole interfaith enterprise has changed. You know, I mentioned this
way?
At the beginning. Oh, I think it's in a lot of ways, we saw it as illustrating a need for us to have greater understanding of each other, to enter into a kind of dialogue human to human, to transcend the boundaries between us. And I think that was accurate, but I don't think it's accurate anymore. I don't think that's the job.
What do you think the job is now?
Oh, I think it's transcending the boundaries. I don't think it is. For instance, for a long time, one of the programs that we felt very good about and kind of expanded in our own way was setting up different kinds of dialogues with people of different faiths, dinner dialogues. And we did that as part of our programs when we would go, you know, speaking, be a keynote or somewhere, and then we'd do a workshop. And the idea was to create contexts where we met each other as human beings. And we saw that as laying a different kind of foundation, so that when we started to talk about specifically religious things, there was already a grounding and a kind of appreciation and understanding of our common humanity. I now appreciate that actually, I don't think that was bad. I just think it was just the barest beginning, and it had the negative was and is the perpetuation of our separateness. Namely, if I share my story with you, which is how we were doing it, you know, we were inviting people to share their story stimulated by certain questions. And it was very clever. I mean, around a table, nobody had the same question, so that it wouldn't help to think of your own answer while someone else is talking, because the question you're going to get is going to be different. Very good. But it was helping us identify ourselves as our story. And frankly, that is enhancing an ego identity that supports our belief in our separateness. And I am absolutely convinced, and Tova Zev, the woman I am working with, has been extraordinarily helpful to me in this. I am absolutely convinced that the root of the sickness that is manifesting in so many radically destructive ways on our planet is a consequence of our belief in separateness. And so the spiritual awakening, the spiritual pursuit, the spiritual truth, the spiritual reality that is needed is a radical awakening to oneness, a radical appreciation of the essential nature of our being, the essential nature of who I am. I am not my ego. I have an ego. My ego helps me operate this particular vehicle in this particular place and time and world. But when I think that's who I am, I'm living in a state of fear. I'm living in a state of separation. I'm living in a state of competition. I'm living in a state of drama. I'm unable to appreciate what's really going on here.
That makes me think of another question I wanted to ask you about. Somewhere I read that the kind of work that the Interfaith Amigos does identifies different kinds of pain that people have experienced. And I loved this because you identified personal pain, communal pain, and interreligious pain. So one, why is it important to acknowledge all three? But two, how important is it that people are able to move through that to get to this ultimate understanding of oneness?
Right. Unfortunately, I think a lot of what we did perpetuated the problem. You know, and it's kind of shocking to notice that. You know, you think you're doing something that's leading somewhere and discover that, wow, that actually, I mean, it didn't make it worse, but it didn't make it better in the ways that we had imagined it would make it better. What, you know, we've been taught, we still talk weekly. I mean, now it's on Zoom because Don lives in Minneapolis. So just Jamal and I are in Seattle. And obviously we haven't met, I'm still not meeting with people personally. As we talk now, I think I'm a little more radical than, and I don't want to make better worse. This is challenging, but I get the sense that I am really interested in moving beyond faith. And that's a radical and challenging thing, particularly for people. Like, I'm not associated with the congregation, so it's easy for me. Yes, we're going to do high holiday services. Yes, you know, I mean, online, but I celebrate ceremony as a way of awakening. But I'm not interested in people becoming Jewish. And frankly, the institutionalized Judaism has virtually no interest in either in interfaith or in what I would call spirituality. The organized community is interested in supporting itself, sustaining itself, growing itself, survival of itself. And along with other religious institutions, preserving separateness.
Mm-hmm. That's certainly the cage, right? I mean, the religious cage is about separating us from other people, but also from each other.
So talk to us about what you are doing now with the Anochi Institute.
Anochi, it's actually the Hebrew word is Anochi.
Anochi, thank you.
But Tova, it was really her, she already had her work under that name. And Anochi is a Hebrew word that means I am. It's one of the first person singular pronouns. In what gets called the Ten Commandments, actually in Torah, they're never called commandments. They're called words, they're called principles, they're called utterances. They're really not commandments. They're descriptions of how things work. And they start with Anochi Adonai Elohecha Asher Hotzeiticha Me'eretz Mitzrayim Mibeit Avadim. Anochi is the first word of the principles. And there is a tradition that that's the only thing that people heard. Everybody heard that. They basically fell down absolutely enlightened. Their minds were blown because they heard I am. But the line, I am the eternal one. I am the oneness that is your God. I am the way you get out of the enslavement, whether the enslavement is Egypt or from any enslavement. The enslavement is your ego. The Anochi is the way out. I am right here. I'm not somewhere else. But since if you normally translate the ch sound into English as ch, like Hanukkah, if you do that with Anochi, people will read it as Anochi, and that's worse. We'd rather have people say Anochi than Anochi. In my work with Tova, which is really unfolding, I mean, we're inviting people to a radically spiritualized High Holy Day observance. You know, people want to find out about it, rabbited.com. You know, there's better links to the actual site about the high holidays, but I don't know it by heart. But if they go to rabbited.com, people can join from everywhere in the world. I mean, this is, you know, that's the benefit of doing things online, just like your podcast. I mean, makes no difference what time zone people are in. It makes no difference where they are. The whole idea of oneness transcends the physical distance of time and space. So in a lot of ways, this meeting online is offering a radical, radical recognition of connection. The very opposite that most people are perceiving. We've been discovering that this year in the classes we've done. It's like, wow, we're right here. And not only that, since we use Zoom, you get to see everybody face to face, which you don't get to do. Normally, when I'm teaching, I get to see everybody's face. They don't get to see their own. They don't get to see each other. But with Zoom, we're here together. And we're transcending. No, it's not about the physical. I mean, yes, each of us comes through a physical, but that which we are is universal. What Tova teaches, we don't have a piece of the universal. I don't have a piece of universal consciousness in me or you. We have the whole thing.
We are. I am.
We're the whole thing. And mm-hmm. It's just in terms of...
Rabbi Ted, if we were in my church, I'd be yelling at you, preach, preach, preach it.
Can you give us an example of what these comings together, these classes that you have online with all of these people who are interacting and seeing each other and being together, what does that feel like? for, say, if I were going to join, how would you want me to feel in that environment?
Ah, so good.
You know, the way, I mean, we've been experimenting. So we are completing, actually this weekend, an 8-month spiral of teaching. And that has led us to really appreciate what's working, what's most helpful, what's less helpful, what do we want to do? We have radically decreased the cost to people. And the program we're offering, and people can get to it if they go to rabbited.com. I mean, they could see, it's, we decided to do it as a membership. People could join, they get the same thing, but they could join at different amounts, depending on what they're able to do. It's a risk for us because we have no physical, you know, I mean, I have no visible means of support. I've got to create something, and I'm less interested in doing individual work. I'm more interested in, I just think the most important thing to do now is work on awakening. Mm-hmm. I just think it's so critical. So let me just say, the program we're offering includes a monthly workshop that starts on the first Saturday of every month that sets the tone, the focus for the month. And then there's a Monday office hour where people come and we can interact, and there's teaching and discussion. There's a Monday evening group meditation. There's ceremonies of new moon, evenings of chant and meditation. There's one Shabbat, a shamanic celebration of Shabbat. It's like Earth Shabbat. It's like connection Shabbat a month. You know, the idea is working with consciousness, with heart opening, and with the embodiment of a consciousness. And it's very exciting. And then there'll be additional classes if people are interested and stuff like that. But the initial offerings, people could have it for as little as $26 a month, which is ridiculous. But it's like, look, this is what's important. Whether you get it here or you get it somewhere else, get it. You know, find a focus to help you, to help us wake up, because we're destroying ourselves, and we're destroying ourselves because we can't get out of our separateness. We got to wake up. We are responsible for the energies of the pool of consciousness from which all of us are nourished. What are we going to add to it? What are we going to add to it? And frankly, group meditation, group participation enhances that which we individually are able to offer. So we're not interested in creating a congregation. We're not interested in creating a religion. We're not, I mean, there's a lot of Hebrew stuff we do because that's our background, but it's not about Jewish.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask, because I actually have been to that website and it looks so great. And I wondered, could I jump in there without having the Jewish background and kind of be able to follow? But it sounds like it transcends religion.
Yeah, look, you know, it's like asking, can you do a Vedic? Can you do a Sanskrit mantra? Can you do a Sanskrit chant? Can you do a Vedantic practice, a yoga, without being Hindu? Yeah. Can you do a Buddhist practice without being Buddha? Well, yes.
Yes and yes.
And there is this reservoir of wisdom. And it's like Hebrew is one of the holy languages of the planet, like Sanskrit. And I know people get all kinds of weird because somehow it's okay to do Sanskrit but not Hebrew, you know. But the reality is that Hebrew, particularly ancient Hebrew, the whole grammar is a spiritual path. It's incredible. I can't believe that my colleagues are not talking about this all the time. It's just astonishing to me.
the language itself is this. I love that you called it a spiritual path.
It is.
It's kind of exciting. I wasn't intimidated when I went to your website. It just kind of made me go,
Yeah,
I want to learn more.
I appreciate that.
Oh, yeah.
We know that that's a question that comes up in people's minds.
Mm-hmm.
And we are best teaching from our own integrity and from our own authenticity.
Yes.
You know, I mean, there's no question that my rooting is in the Hebrew tradition. Tova's rooting. I mean, totally independent of me, but just finding each other and finding that, I don't know how many years ago, 50 years ago? Well, I don't know. Both of us had the same Hebrew, found the same Hebrew mantra, you know, that we've been using in meditation.
What?
And it's not uncommon mantra. It's right there. I mean,
can you share that mantra with us?
Well, sure. It's the Shema.
Look,
if you just read the text, I'm living in Los Angeles. I'm doing what I'm doing. I'm basically earning my living as a psychotherapist, and I have a part-time alternative congregation, you know, that is doing some kind of meditation and trying to recapture the spirituality as best I could understand it at the time. And I had a practice of, from time to time, opening a traditional prayer book. I mean, it's not what I use or anything, but just opening it wherever it opened and using it as a contemplation, using it as a kind of, it's called hitbonenut. Hitbodedut is real meditation. It means being alone with oneself. Hitbonenut is a contemplative practice. And I opened it up, and it opened to the Shema. The line that followed it, obviously, the one that says, and you love the Eternal One, your God, with all your heart, with all your soul. And I almost closed up the book, because I've read that a million times. Why do I need to look at that? And for some reason, I said, let me look at that. Well, the lines say, these words, which I give you today, need to be on your heart. In biblical idiom, heart was where one thought. You didn't feel with your heart then. You thought with your heart, which is interesting in itself. Now that we know that the heart actually has brain cells. I mean, you know, there's stuff. Repeat them when you sit in your house, when you walk, when you're sitting in your house, when you're walking by the way, when you lie down and when you rise up. And I read that and I said, you know, if I had read that in an Eastern teaching, I would know they're talking about a mantra to be done all the time. And I went, in modern language, I went, OMG. I went, oh my God, this is. So I started doing that. And my goal was to have the Shema, those six words, operating in my consciousness all the time. I wanted to know how soon after I awakened in the morning could they be there? How far could I take them into sleep? Could I hold them even in the midst of everything else that's going on? And things started changing for me.
Would you indulge us with those words in both Hebrew and English?
Oh, that's
just
a
six
problem.
Words.
It's a problem.
Uh-oh.
Because translation is a problem. One of the benefits of using a language like Sanskrit or Hebrew is that the words are more open because we haven't closed them with definition like we do when we use an English word if we are English speakers. Hebrew, the tenses in biblical Hebrew are not like the tenses in modern Hebrew. They're more open. They're fluid. And there's not time to go into this, but so the problem with translating, I would say, the energy of those words essentially convey all there is one. There's only one. And we're it. We're it. It's not something outside us. It is us It is ours. The language might sound like blessed are you, as if we're talking to somebody outside. There is nobody outside. There is no outside. That's just
That's totally an illusion. Lovely.
That's totally an illusion.
That right there, what you have just said, is an awakening for me.
See? That's working. One down.
It's working, Rabbi Ted.
That's so great. Maybe we should end on that note because it was such a high note.
I don't want to mess it up now.
Oh my gosh, it's been so great. There's nothing that you wish that we had asked you that we haven't covered.
You've given me a chance to do a lot of talking. You've been great.
We're so grateful.
I would appreciate, links to what you do with this. I do appreciate encouraging people to look at RabbiTed.com. Essentially brings people to the Anoki Institute. We're dedicating our lives to doing what we can to help ourselves and help each other wake up.
And listeners, we'll have links in the show notes to Rabbi Ted's website, as well as the Interfaith Amigos and the Anoki Institute websites. We'll have all of those so you can go to them pretty easily. And just thank you so much for your time today. We really appreciate it. Thank you. Thank you.
It's been a pleasure, Deborah and Robin. It's good to talk to you. And here we go.
Thank you.
Whatever energies, in a very few weeks come the High Holy Days. And may all of you and all of us be especially blessed with the energies of opening and awakening and love and compassion that unfold from these special days.
And that is the note on which we will close. Thank you for listening to the Incarcerated Christian Podcast. We invite you to rate and review our show. And remember, you can find this interview and others on our website, theincarceratedchristian.com, or anywhere you access podcasts. Don't forget to connect with us on Instagram and TikTok at The Incarcerated Christian, and on Twitter at @TCPodcast_. You can find more information about us and our show on our website. Again, that's theincarceratedchristian.com. Until next time, go forth in love and light.